It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll be talking about immigration reform in the United States.
But first, we'll take a look at a Swedish lawn game that's taken hold here in Wisconsin.
It's called Cub, and while it started out as, or Cub, we're going to find out in just a few minutes. And while it started out as somewhat of an obscure game, some people might say it's still obscure. It's gained quite the following in recent years.
And this weekend, Eau Claire is hosting the U.S. National Cub Tournament, which
or
will
is
bring...
that Cub Tournament?
Stop saying that, Gene. I'm working really hard to say Cub. With spelled K-U-B-B, right? So that's why the confusion here. Chris will tell us all about that in a moment. But apparently at this tournament, there will be more than 300 players from around the nation playing Cub in the Chippewa Valley.
Our Central Time producer, Chris Molina, has played in past tournaments. He is an avid Cub fan, and he joins us now to give us a primer on what the game is and how you can get started playing it. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Gene. Hey, Veronica. And I will just say that the one question that I think I get more than anything else is, how do you say that word? So the confusion over it, you know, I've heard that one before. So it is Cub, to the best of my knowledge, but I'm willing to hear arguments otherwise.
And it's Cub spelled K-U-B-B.
K-U-B-B, correct.
So let's start with the basics. How did a Swedish lawn game wind up in Wisconsin?
Well, that's a really good question, Gene. This game, Cub, you know, the origins of the game are a little bit unclear, but what we do know is that this game actually originated on the island of Gotland, Sweden. And, you know, we're not really sure how it evolved into, you know, this game having to do with wooden blocks. The best rumor that, you know, Cub fans like to say is that it was created by the Vikings. And instead of using, you know, wooden blocks, they actually used the bones and the skulls of their opponents and the people who they, you know, slaughtered in their pillaging. There's no factual evidence for this whatsoever. But, you know, it's one of those fun things that, you know, Cub players like to throw around when trying to explain their game. As to how it came to Wisconsin, you know, Eau Claire, I went to school at UW-Eau Claire, and that's kind of where I started playing it. The game just kind of took off there, and I was thinking about this earlier today, and it seems to me that Eau Claire is just, it's a quirky enough community, and I say that in a really good way, because I love the city of Eau Claire. It's a quirky enough city that it embraced this incredibly quirky game, and everyone just fell in love with it. And I think that, you know, as more and more people started playing it there, it started to spread out around the state a little bit. You know, when they first started doing this tournament, which we can talk more in a little bit about, you know, they were having anywhere from, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 teams in the first tournament. Now we're up to like 88 teams.
88 teams. That's crazy.
It's crazy. And people are coming from all over now. I know, you know, Madison has a tournament now, but there are teams from Madison. There are teams from all over Wisconsin. I think one of the last tournaments I played in, there was a team from California who was there, a team from Montana. So people come from all over the place to play this game.
Well, you brought in these strange-looking accoutrements. I assume they're part of the Cub repertoire. They look like fence posts to me, but that could be because you bought them at Menard. I don't know if these are standard-issue Cub
sets.
Things.
Yeah.
Sets. Well, describe what's in front of us here.
Sure. So what I have in front of me is the standard issue Cub set. You know, it used to be a little bit harder to get your hands on a Cub set. You used to have to go to a specialty gaming store. And I think around that time, they would run anywhere from about, you know, $50 to $75, depending on where you went, or you'd have to buy it off the internet. And actually, this Cub set that I have in front of me just came from Menards, and I think the price has come way down on them. And, you know, they're just wooden blocks. So, I mean, if you're crafty, you can certainly make a set yourself if you want to go that route. And that's actually, I've known, you know, some players who have done that with their families, but, you know, they've carved the wood.
So what is this piece in your hand? It's like a long cylinder. And by the way, there's a picture on Facebook and Twitter, by the way, if you want to see what we're talking about. Chris is holding a cylindrical wooden piece
of wood. Looks like a stick.
Yeah.
Stick.
So I've got a baton in my right hand here. Basically, there are three pieces that go along with Cub. You've got your baton, which basically you use to throw at these small wooden blocks, which are called Cubs. Now I've got a Cub in my hand right here. It's a small wooden block that's maybe about, oh, I don't know, you know, 9-10 inches tall. You know, not too wide. So basically, that's your second piece. And you've also got the king. And this is the big boy when it comes to Cub. This is kind of like the eight ball in pool. You don't want to mess with it until the very end.
So what do you do? You've got how many of these blocks? You've got the king. Where are they How do you get the baton there?
Sure. So you start, you plan a pitch, and the pitch is probably around, I think, 26 feet long and about 16 feet wide. You've got two teams playing, one team on either side of the pitch, and on each side you set up five of these cube blocks, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and each team gets six batons.
You set them up in any pattern or just a random pattern?
Just in a straight line.
Okay.
So, you know, each team, you can have anywhere from 1 to 6 players on a team. Tournament rules now state that you have to have 3 players on a team, but if you're just playing casually because you have 6 batons, you could have 1 person, you could have 6 people, and that's one of the great parts about this game is you can play it with however many people you have, which is great. And when you have curious passerbys, you know, come by and, you know, say, what the heck is that game that you're playing? You know, you just say, like, hey, come on over and play. So anyways, I'm digressing a little bit here. So basically, you'll start on one side of the pitch and you throw your batons, and the idea is you want to knock over your opponent's cubes. Now, that goes back and forth a little bit. So once your turn is done, you actually, the other team will take the cubes that got knocked over and throw them back onto the other side of the pitch.
Hmm.
Then the other team has to knock down those field cubes, is what they're called now, before they can knock down the baseline cubes over on the back of the pitch. Now, some strategy comes in, because once you start knocking down a lot of cubes, you know, it gets pretty hard to knock them all down in a single turn. And if you can't knock them all down in a single turn, the other team can move up to where...
closer.
They can move closer to wherever, you know, there's a field cube. If it's still standing, they can move up to that cube, which essentially gives them easier shots. So there's some strategy that comes in here, and I think this is one of the reasons that some people refer to it as Viking chess, is, you know, where do you throw these field cubes? Do you throw them all together and try to knock down 3 with one baton? Do you space them out? Do you throw them way in back where they're a little bit harder to hit, but your opponents aren't going to be able to move up, you know, that far if they miss? There's a lot of strategy in this game.
I was going to say it sounded like bizarro bowling at first, but then when you describe moving the pieces around and then being flung back at you in your direction, that's different.
And, you know, I've heard it also described as a combination between bowling and horseshoes. So there is kind of that element of bowling in there. So that's not too far off.
So how long does a match take?
A match can take anywhere from a couple of minutes to, I think, the longest one that I've played in was about an hour and a half. The idea being you play 3 games, 3 matches, you know, and then you've got a set, you know, so the best of 3, essentially. And I've had one of those take, you know, a couple minutes. You can throw a perfect game. Some tournaments won't allow you to do this, but, you know, because you've got 6 batons and there are 5 cubes in the back, you know, boom, 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 boom. And then you've got a shot at the king, which is the other part of the game that I haven't described yet, is that once you knock down all of the cubes, once you've got a free field there, there's the king in the middle, and you have to knock down the king to win the game. Now, if you knock the king down at any other point in the game, your team loses the game. So again, it's that, you know, 8 ball and pool metaphor right there. So yeah, once you get the king down, then you win. So you've got to win 2 matches in order to win the game.
Does Swedes actually still play this game, or is this just something that quirky Americans have picked up?
They still play the game. As far as I know, the largest tournament in the world still takes place on the island of Gotland. And so the U.S. national tournament is actually the second largest tournament in the world, which is a pretty, you know, big accomplishment, you know, for Wisconsin and Eau Claire especially. And Eau Claire has really embraced the game of Cube as well, which is really cool. I think a couple of years back, the city council actually voted to make the city the Cube capital of America. And I mean, and you know, and they're getting, you know, tourism dollars and everything else, and it's been great economically for the city. So I think, you know, other cities are a little bit jealous of Eau Claire now, but yeah, no, they've done a lot to, you know, embrace the Cube community, which is great, and it's growing all the time too, which is fantastic.
So have you played in the U.S. Nationals?
You know, I've played in the U.S. Nationals, which sounds like really intimidating. It sounds
does.
Like I'm really good at Cube.
Or like it's really easy to get into the Nationals.
Thanks, Veronica. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to get into the tournament. I mean, there's no, you know, qualifiers. You don't have to, you know, qualify at the regional Cube tournament in your region. It's basically, you know, if you want to play, you can play. And it's gotten, you know, as it's grown, you know, they've had to cap the amount of teams that they'll let in for logistical purposes, you know, but it's still, if you want to play and you sign up early enough, they're going to let you play. And it's such a great way to, you know, to play in the tournament. I barely had any experience when I played in my first tournaments. And it was a great way to actually learn a lot about the game, you know, because I played against people who had been playing for years and years and years. And, you know, they basically said, you know, hey, you know, you're a good coup player. Here are a couple of tips to maybe make you a little bit better.
So Coobers are a friendly lot.
They're an incredibly friendly lot. And I think, you know, everyone kind of takes passion in the fact that, you know, we're all in this together. We have this sort of obscure game that we love. And if people ask you about it, you know, they're going to let you play. So, I mean, if you see people out, you know, in a park near you and they're throwing around some wooden batons, you know, feel free to stop and just ask them what they're doing. And I can pretty much guarantee you that they're going to call you over and just put a baton in your hand and say, here, throw this. So please approach them. I promise they're friendly. They won't bite.
Well, all right. It sounds like the game's a little less obscure than it was just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and you know, it's getting more popular all the time. So I'm worried I'm going to work myself out of a job here talking about it on Wisconsin Public Radio at some point.
All right. Well, Chris, thanks for joining us and telling us about Coob, or as Gene likes to call it, Cub.
Right, but I know better now through this. It is Coob, and Chris, again, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Chris Molina is one of our producers here on Central Time, and as you can tell, he is a big Coob fan.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Senate passed a sweeping immigration bill that included a possible pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants, hinging on a significant increase in border security. Although that bill was drafted by the partisan Gang of Eight, many have been skeptical since then that a broad immigration bill of its kind will make it through Congress.
And this week, both Democrats and Republicans in the House have met amongst themselves to discuss.
During this segment, we'll be taking your calls on the future of the Senate's immigration bill. You can reach us at 800-642-1234 or by email at talk@wpr.org. Here to give us an update on the House's response to the Senate immigration bill is New York Times congressional reporter Ashley Parker. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, 2 weeks ago, everybody was talking about all the bipartisanship going on over in the Senate and talking, although looking ahead to the House and acknowledging there are going to be some issues there. Take us from there to here. 2 weeks ago, and all of a sudden, yesterday, it all wound up where a lot of people predicted it would.
Exactly. So basically what happened, the immigration bill passed the Senate right before the 4th of July recess in a sweeping bipartisan vote. I think it 68 senators voted for it total, including 14 Republicans. And the hope in the Senate and among immigration advocates was that that sort of bipartisan support and momentum would, you know, help move the bill through the House. But if there's one thing the House made clear yesterday, it's that whatever they do, and they may do something, it will not be what the Senate has passed.
So we've heard the public declarations from the House, but a lot of those discussions took place behind closed doors. Any sense of what they're saying in there?
Yeah, so they had a big closed-door meeting sort of yesterday afternoon in the basement of the Capitol. It lasted for over 2 hours. And in it, you know, they described it largely as a listening session and a chance for the leadership to sort of make their pitch and a chance for the committee chairman who run committees that deal with immigration to sort of give an update on where their progress is. But it was largely a listening session for members to voice their concerns and say what worries them. And so what sort of came out of that meeting was that Speaker Boehner warned Republicans about the high political cost of inaction and basically said, we don't have to do the Senate bill. We don't have to do anything similar to the Senate bill, but we absolutely have to do something on immigration. And then in terms of what they're going to do, they're still trying to figure that out. But what is clear is whatever they do, they're on a slow timeline. They feel no urgency to get this done. It's likely that we'll sort of go through the summer. We'll go to the August break. When we come back, it'll be fall, and there'll be, you know, debt ceiling fights and budget fights. And so immigration may not even get really taken up in earnest again until the beginning of next year. So that's one thing. It'll be slow, and their approach will be a piecemeal approach. So rather than the comprehensive bill in the Senate, it'll be sort of individual bills, each dealing with a smaller portion of the law.
And talk a little bit about the rationale, because they've been talking about that idea of taking it step by step.
The big issue there is that the thing that is tough for them to get behind, especially House Republicans, is a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented immigrants who are already in the country, or even a path to legalization. And so in a comprehensive approach includes that pathway. That's actually sort of at the core of a comprehensive approach, and that's the way that, you know, Democrats and immigration advocates believe that this gets done. But the House, because the citizenship issue is such a controversial issue, and that was sort of the question at the core of yesterday's private meeting, which they didn't come up with an answer to, but because citizenship is such a big issue, their attitude is, you know, look, let's take the portions we can agree on. We can all maybe agree on border security, or we can all maybe agree on visas for high-skilled workers, and let's just try to deal with the parts where there's broad agreement. And Republicans also argue that they don't trust the federal government. They don't trust the Obama administration, and so they worry that a comprehensive approach gets unwieldy, that it becomes like Obamacare, there's too much in it, it gets rushed through, and if they can do it piece by piece, they sort of feel more comfortable with the process.
So really, part of it, though, that it kind of comes down to the idea of citizenship versus legalization.
Yeah, or frankly, not wanting to deal with either of those mm-hmm. issues.
So one of the reactions so far I saw from John McCain and Chuck Schumer today, they say, and they were part of the Gang of Eight, they say that the Senate is not going to, quote, Bigfoot the House on this legislation. What do they mean by that? And can they Bigfoot the House?
Well, part of it is exactly is that they can't, right? I mean, a lot of these House members don't care at all what happens in the other chamber, and frankly, it could be a little counterproductive. They might feel, you know, offended, and they certainly don't want to feel condescended to by the senators. So part of it is that they can't, and the senators realize it would be counterproductive. But I will say, while these senators are publicly saying, and they mean that the House does have to work its will, they are definitely behind the scenes trying to do whatever they can to influence what's going on in the House, whether it's, you know, working with business groups who they worked with on the Senate bill to lobby House members, or whether it's working with the evangelical community to lobby, you know, Senate member or House members in districts where that would be a compelling pitch. So they are working behind the scenes, certainly.
And one thing we forgot to mention, we've been talking about yesterday's meeting of Republicans, but Democrats met on Tuesday to talk about the Senate's bill. What can you give us an idea of what that discussion was like?
Yeah, so there's sort of Senator Schumer came out of that meeting and said there was, you know, complete and total unity among Dems, although I think that might have been a bit overstated. There's sort of two main approaches Democrats are considering. The one that Senator Schumer and a lot of Democrats believe is that their argument is they will not support or agree to go to conference, which is where the Senate and the House sort of negotiate the two bills together and come out with a final product. They will not go to conference, and they will not negotiate with the House on any immigration legislation that does not include a pathway to citizenship. They say that's a deal breaker for them, and their thought is that if all the Democrats in the House hold back their support, House Republicans won't be able to pass anything because, you know, Speaker Boehner has a contingent who won't, including, you know, for instance, Steve King of Iowa, who will not vote for any form of immigration reform. So the Dems think if they hold back their votes, Boehner can't get anything passed. He'll be in a tough political situation. Republicans will be blamed, and Republicans will sort of have to play ball. So that's one option. The other option is you have Dems who say, let's just get to conference committee. Let's help the Republicans pass something because that will get us to a conference. And in conference, we can play ball and try to push them on what we care about, which is a path to citizenship.
So divisions all over the place.
Exactly. So, although the Dems are much more unified than the Republicans.
Yeah, and it Speaker Boehner is in that really unusual place because of the division within the GOP. At some level, it matters what Democrats think, you know, I mean, even though they're the minority.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen other sort of, there have been a handful, and he's in a tough position because his members don't want him to violate the Hastert rule, which means that they don't want Speaker Boehner to bring any bill to the floor for a vote that does not have the majority of his conference, the majority of Republicans behind it. There have been a handful of instances so far this year. One was a fiscal cliff. One was relief for Hurricane Sandy victims, where Speaker Boehner brought legislation to the floor anyhow and passed it with Democratic support because he just has such an unwieldy conference that has so many factions, including sort of far-right conservatives and Tea Party members who just aren't going to help him do anything. So he sometimes does need Democratic help.
You know, it's interesting. A couple of weeks ago when the Senate passed this, we heard how important it is. We've been hearing how important something for immigration is for Republicans, for Democrats, for everybody, and we're moving right along. And then all of a sudden, you know, it hits the House and we have to go step by step. We're slowing it down. The August recess is coming up. We've got plenty of time. So if it's so important, why is it taking so long?
Well, it's funny. Immigration is an issue that is very important to Democrats, very important to immigration advocates, and important to a lot of Republicans on a national level. just because of the changing demographics in the country. And it became very important to them after Mitt Romney lost the presidential election and President Obama received 71% of the Hispanic vote, right? So the National Republican Party cares a lot about it. But on a district-by-district basis among House members, because of redistricting and gerrymandering, most House members have very safe conservative seats, and their biggest threat is not is from a primary from the right over people who will be upset about them voting in favor of immigration reform. And a lot of them have largely white districts. They don't represent a lot of Hispanics, again, because of gerrymandering. And so on a personal level, the smart thing to do may not be to vote for immigration reform. On a long-term national level, it probably is.
Wow, lots to think about. We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we will continue our discussion with Ashley Parker, congressional reporter for The New York Times. And when we return, we'd like to hear from you, too, on the future of the Senate's immigration bill. First of all, what did you think about that bill as it came out of the Senate? What do you think is happening now as it appears stalled in the House? And what should members of Congress be thinking about during that August break? 800-642-1234, or drop us an email. That address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're back discussing the future of immigration reform in the wake of news out of Washington yesterday and out of the House of Representatives that it is going to be a tough sell there and nothing is likely to happen very much for the foreseeable future, next couple of months anyway. We'll be taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the state of the immigration reform legislation? Does it matter to you here in Wisconsin? What happens in Washington? Does it make a difference in your life? Do you support the plan as it came out of the Senate? What should happen in the House? 800-642-1234. With us to talk about this and shed some light on it is Ashley Parker, congressional reporter for The New York Times. And Ashley Parker, before we get to calls from listeners, one person we haven't heard from in a long time weighed in on this. Former President George W. Bush talked yesterday in favor of immigration reform. And I forget the exact phrase he used. I think benevolence was in there somewhere. But tell us a little bit about that. Why did he decide all of a sudden, because we haven't heard a lot from him lately, that this is something he needed to weigh in on?
Well, the thing people or some people forget about President Bush is that he has sort of immigration reform has always been one of his big issues. He actually tried to get it done back when he was president in 2007. It was one of his sort of final things, and he just couldn't quite manage it. And he said, I think, in a final press conference, that one of his biggest regrets was not trying to do immigration reform when he sort of had the political clout to do it. Because at that point, he was unpopular with Democrats and even unpopular with members of his own party. But, he's from Texas, and this has been something that's always been important to him, actually. And also, if you look at his family, his brother Jeb is very involved in immigration reform, speaks fluent Spanish. I think he has a nephew who's getting involved. So in a way, it's sort of a Bush family issue.
So here's the thing. Did his remarks make any difference?
That's an open question, but I will say, unlike President Obama, who many members want to just stay out of this debate entirely because some Republicans find him so objectionable that if he wades in, it will almost push them further away from reform. I certainly don't think former President Bush's comments hurt in any way.
Let's go to the phones right now and find out what listeners have to think. By the way, if you would like to join in, here's our number. It is 800-642-1234, and we begin with Scott from Whitewater.
Thank you. We definitely need to do an immigration bill in the U.S. And my question is, Obama flexing the State Department's arm, saying, okay, we're not going to fine and round up these immigrants, but what we are going to do is deal with kind of the illegal employment problem and start fining companies that are hiring these people. For instance, you know, go to the Chamber of Commerce and say, hey, you guys are going to start paying some steep fines for each individual that you illegal hire, or let's fix immigration.
Thanks so much for the Scott. Thanks for the call. We'll put it to our guest, Ashley Parker. He's proposing kind of a roundabout way of applying pressure. Are we likely to see anything like that happen?
Yeah. So it's interesting he mentioned that. You know, talking about sort of interior enforcement, cracking down on employers who hire illegal people, is actually a huge part of the Senate bill. With E-Verify, you know, an electronic verification system. So basically, if this in the Senate bill, employers in it sort of they would all have to be up and running within a 5-year time frame, and when each employer has to be up and running is based on how large they are. But the gist is that because enforcement was such a big part of the Senate bill, is that all of these employers would be responsible for using a system that ensure they did not hire illegal immigrants, and if they did, yeah, there would be harsh punishments and fines. And this is something that even Mitt Romney would talk about in the campaign trail. A lot of people say, you know, it's turning off the magnet. Immigrants come to the country for all sorts of reasons, but if they weren't able to work here and make money and oftentimes send it home, the magnet would be gone and they wouldn't cross the border.
Let's go to Eileen now, and Eileen is with us from Dodgeville. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess I'm wondering if it seems to me as if when they talk about illegal immigration and that they're looking at, or it seems to me they're looking at people that are coming from the southern border of the U.S. How about all the people that are coming, like, from Europe or Africa or Asia, coming from the east?
Let's talk about numbers, Ashley Parker. Where are the immigrants coming from?
So one of the things they actually did talk a lot about in the process of the Senate bill is that 40% of illegal immigrants are not people who snuck over the border, but are visa overstays, people who came here illegally as a tourist, as a student, you know, from all over the place. I don't have specific numbers on specific countries, but 40% of illegal immigrants are visa overstays who came to the country legally and then just never left. So you're right. So a portion, another enforcement portion of the Senate bill would basically be implementing an electronic entry-exit system to the country. So, you know, the government would be able to better track you coming in and then make sure that you didn't just stay.
But it does, Eileen's point about it seems as though our eyes turn south when this debate starts taking place. I mean, is that an accurate perception of how it's being played out in the media and other places?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, it is certainly true. We talk more about the southern border than the border with Canada. Some people joke that the reason we don't talk about the border with Canada is because Canada has very hospitable policies for immigrants. So if they get to Canada, they sort of think, well, why not just stay here legally instead of sneaking over into the United States? And yeah, there certainly are, you know, thousands of illegal immigrants who stream over the southern border. That's absolutely true, but that's not the only place they're coming from.
So as we look ahead, what is the thinking that if nothing happens, what is the result of all that? If after all of this we go through months and months of agonizing and at the end of it, nothing, then what?
Well, one of the arguments that people make that I've heard, you know, Senator Marco Rubio make, but basically anyone who, especially Republicans who want immigration reform, is that, you know, if nothing happens, so the people who don't want immigration reform to happen, they warn that, you know, any reform is amnesty, right, which they're opposed to. But the counterpoint is that the current system we have right now is de facto amnesty. You have these 11 million people, and sure, they're not legal and they're breaking the law, but they're here, they're in the shadows, they're oftentimes working in jobs, they're part of, you know, the fabric of our communities, and it's not ideal to have 11 million people in the country living and working illegally.
So what is the likelihood that something will happen, though? I mean, we know what came out of the Senate. We kind of know where the House is now. We kind of know the speed at which everybody is moving. But then we hear from people like Paul Ryan from here in Wisconsin, who says, you know, the GOP needs to tackle this right now. Speaker Boehner says it's important. The Democrats say it's important. Is it likely, in your estimation, that we will wind up with something?
I mean, that is sort of the question. in Congress, as I'm sure you know, has a tough time sort of these days getting anything done. But I will say there certainly are a lot of forces who would like some sort of reform done. As you mentioned, Senator Ryan was in that closed-door meeting, Congressman Ryan was making an economic argument. You have evangelical groups making a religious argument in favor of reform. You have business groups making a business argument. You have, sort of immigration advocates making another argument. So it's unclear what will happen, but you certainly have a lot of people who, for a lot of different reasons, would like to see something done.
And are you making any bets right now as to which way it's going to go? I mean, are we going to be seeing a reprise of the Senate bill, elements of that making it through, or something completely different?
I think we'll see the Senate bill only in the broadest sense, that sort of all of the issues the Senate bill addresses, whether it's border security or interior enforcement or legalization or high-skilled workers and agriculture workers, they all need to be addressed likely in the House bill, but they could address them with totally different solutions.
All right. Sounds like we've got a ways to go on this one. Thanks so much for joining us, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Ashley Parker. She is a congressional reporter for The New York Times.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's wedding season, and we're going to be talking about how America's bridezilla culture is spreading beyond the U.S. That's coming up in a bit.
But before we get to that, we're going to talk about some of America's prominent achievers and their obsessiveness. Obsessive compulsiveness is often thought of as a disorder, but according to our next guest, it can also be an asset.
Take Thomas Jefferson or Charles Lindbergh, for example. Today, they might have been diagnosed with OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder.
And here with us to discuss is Joshua Kendall. He is the author of America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, first of all, it's a very interesting book, and the people you chose are people, some of them are pretty much household names, some of them a little bit deeper, but all very interesting. I want to start out a little bit talking about this idea of obsessiveness and what it is, because you talk about in there the difference between OCPD and OCD, and when you start getting into those sorts of letters and things, I think people can get confused.
Yes, I do start the book with a little background about the nomenclature. The phrase OCD is flung around a lot. People will start cleaning up furiously, and they'll say, oh, there are a few spots on the floor, and my OCD is popping up. But that's the way it's used loosely. But to get to the technical meanings, OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, is an impairing disorder. People with that disorder have trouble functioning. They're not going to be like the icons in my book, like Steve Jobs or Charles Lindbergh. They're going to be afraid to go out of the house because they have to check the burner 100 times. They're afraid the house is going to burn down. So they're impaired, and they'll often seek psychiatric treatment, maybe medication. They know something is wrong, and they need help. Now, the personality disorder, those are people who have some of the same obsessions with cleanliness, rules, and order, but they thrive on their obsessions. They have more energy than normal people. They're better than well. And they turn their obsessions around into their brand. Steve Jobs was obsessed with cleanliness. He used to go onto the floor of the Apple factory when Apple started rolling out computers in the 1980s with white gloves checking for dust. And when he found a few specks, he'd bark at his assistant to clean it up. And he was proud that his company was very clean. The same went for Henry Heinz of ketchup fame. His factory in Pittsburgh was a must-see tourist destination for half a century precisely because it was so clean. And these are people who function very well, but they can be very difficult, and as I argue in the book, they're the types of people who can drive other family members into psychiatric treatment. They're very tough on their wives and their children, but they, in our furiously competitive society, they really have what it takes to become super achievers. As I wrote in a piece for Slate a couple of weeks ago, it was called Madness Made Them Great, and hard work and intelligence can take you only so far, but to be a super achiever, it seems as if that maniacal overdrive can come in handy. And that's what the seven icons in my book all had.
And let me ask you this before we go any farther. Do you have to have that sort of personality to be a super achiever?
it certainly comes in handy. And what I want to say in the book is that it's a standard path to greatness that's been overlooked, and that there's something about, there's a relationship between the internal preoccupations of certain people. Steve Jobs was always thinking about designing insanely great products. That was more important to him than life itself. When he was dying of cancer, he had a mask on his face, an oxygen mask, in the hospital, and he ripped it off and started yelling at his doctors, please design me a new mask. I mean, that's what he was thinking about, and I want to connect people's internal preoccupations to their external achievements. But there are obviously other pathways to achievement. You know, some people can be great husbands, great fathers, and great inventors, but this is a standard one, and it's been overlooked. And I think with our hero, with our superachievers, we tend to idealize them and say, well, Thomas Jefferson, who's one of the icons covered, you know, the Declaration of Independence was brilliant, so everything about him just must have been perfect. And I'm really trying to humanize them, because biographers tend to either idealize or demonize. And I'm trying to say, yes, the achievements are incredible, the iPhone or ketchup, which is our national sauce, or the 400 batting average. I talk about Ted Williams, he's one of the icons, but that they're also, that these folks were also a little bit unbalanced, and we're used to the idea of an unbalanced artist. Sylvia Plath was a great poet, and depression was her brand. I mean, she wrote about her depression, but the idea of unbalanced politicians or inventors, I mean, we have a sense that that might be so, but we really don't know the details. And I argue that obsessive compulsive personality disorder is sort of the superachiever's disease. It fits very well with what they have to do.
Yeah, you mentioned Thomas Jefferson a few seconds ago, and it's interesting because you talked earlier as well about the difficulties that a lot of these people have with their family relations. And you mentioned in the book with his daughter that you said parental love meant teaching her to be a good obsessive, you know. So it's interesting that they see that in themselves to a certain extent, that that becomes a way for others to be successful as well.
Right. Thomas Jefferson tried to raise his daughter by steeping her in his obsessions. He liked rules and order, so he gives her a schedule and tries to get her to obey rules. A lot of my obsessives are list makers. Charles Lindbergh was a list maker. And he also kept a list, a kind of mega chart on all his children, and he kept track of their infractions and their chewing gum. Ted Williams was a manager of the Washington Senators after he finished his career with the Red Sox, and he would try to steep his players in his obsessions, like Jefferson would steep his daughters. Williams loved his bat. His bat was like his love object. He's kissing his bat. He would hold it with him all the time, and he would tell his hitters to carry the bat around with them all the time. And for Williams, it actually worked. His team's batting average went up by about 30 points. But that's their approach to life, and they immediately assume that everyone else should have the same approach. Ted Williams, is the way he said hello was, "Show me your swing." He'd go up to 80-year-olds in wheelchairs, and he'd say, "Show me your swing," because he assumed that everyone was thinking about hitting as much as he was.
Yeah, it's interesting. When did this occur to you, or when did you get that aha moment that having this type of personality, this type of drive, this type of obsessiveness could be a path to success? I mean, was this something that sort of came upon you suddenly one day, or did it creep up on you?
Well, it crept up on me. I've written two books about obsessive dictionary makers, Noah Webster, the author of America's First Dictionary, and Peter Marc Roget, the author of Roget's Thesaurus, and they were obsessive wordsmiths, and it kind of made sense to me. Okay, if someone likes words and lists, that fits well with making a dictionary. But I never realized until recently that same temperament could be responsible for success in so many different fields. That's why I chose people in different arenas. So Ted Williams was in sports. Henry Heinz was in marketing. Thomas Jefferson was in politics. Melville Dewey, the librarian, was information technology. And I wanted to show that to make it to the top in just about any arena, obsessiveness can come in handy.
And sometimes the obsessiveness, you know, sort of spreads out from You have they had obsessions in a number of different areas, whether it's politics and keeping lists and so forth. But like with Alfred Kinsey, the Kinsey Report, sex was it for him, or it seemed like it.
Yeah, his wife said something cute to Life magazine in the late 40s. I never see Alfred at night anymore ever since he took up sex. Alfred, he was a biologist, and then in the late 40s, he turns to the sex surveys. And you know, he was thinking about sex all the time. But Kinsey is someone who's not that well known today, but he's really been in the news a lot the last 2 or 3 months with all the changes about gay marriage and the increasing acceptance of gay marriage. And that really was his project 50 years ago, is to make the culture more tolerant to different expressions of sexuality. And that took a tremendous amount of guts and courage. And I argue that each of my obsessors was an innovator. My concept is the obsessive innovator, and that's what Kinsey did. But he himself was full of his own quirks, or as his people have written full-length biographies, talk about his demons. And it took someone with these obsessions, who he was a little out of control sexually. He would have constant short-term relationships, and he would there was sex in the attic, and he would have sex with all his employees. He was a little bit out of control, but at the same time, he achieved something great, just like the other icons in the book.
So some people listening to this might think, well, all I have to do is get obsessive about something, and I too can be successful. But my guess is it's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, people, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, please give me this mental illness if it's going to make me, you know, be like Steve Jobs and I'm going to revolutionize 7 industries and become a billionaire. You know, give it to me. But the problem is that you've either got it or you don't. But I think at the same time, we can learn from, there is a kind of how-to part of this book, and that we can learn if you've got it, you need to make the most of it. Or if you're on a corporate board and there's a CEO like Steve Jobs, you have to realize, you know, what this person is capable of, and to, you know, learn how to bring out the best of him and try to keep the possible dark sides under wraps. But there are people like that, and you know, if you're a venture capitalist, and there's a 25-year-old, and he doesn't make good eye contact, and he's geeky, but he seems really obsessed with his new, a website or something. You might want to give him your money, but you might not want to let him date your daughter. That he's likely to be as inflexible and as difficult as someone like a Lindbergh or a Thomas Jefferson.
Wow, lots to think about, and amazing some of these success stories. Joshua Kendall, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today and talk about your new book, America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And don't forget, you can catch up on what's happening here on Central Time on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.